amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing Footsie, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Welcome to the Playing Footsie Show. I'm Steve W. I've got Steve D with me. No Paul this week, but we've got plenty of other things to talk about. It's been an interesting 7 days in the stock market and the financial and investing world. There's been all kinds of things pushing share prices in either direction, uncertainty in the Middle East, in fact, action in the Middle East, followed by some macroeconomic stuff from the US concerning rates and bond yields and movements in the bond market. We're mostly going to leave that to one side for today and focus on some stuff that's a little bit closer to home. Steve, how are you? How's your week been? Your portfolio doing well? Are you doing well?
I'm doing all right, Steve, yeah. It's been another slow week at work. I think that'll come across a bit later on when we talk about Forterra. I'm doing all right. Portfolio is doing okay. I would have been up about 2.5% on the week, but we had a bit of a dodgy Friday, so I'm up about 1%, which again is not to be sniffed at. You take 1% a week for the rest of my life, that'd be fine. Did a bit of trading on Friday. So you say trading, it's just swapping around stuff, really. I decided to take profit on my LSEG position, London Stock Exchange Group. I took about a 15% return on that. I've posted it on the Pi if you're interested in snooping around on that. But I spread some money around, Steve. I bought a little position in DS Spiff. I upped my position in Money Supermarket. I upped my position in Kering, Four Corners Property Trust, Fortinet, Entain. And then I got dividends in from Alexandria, Four Corners, and Forterra. So I went out shopping again, Steve, and I bought more Fortinet, more Adyen, more DS Spiff, and more Bloomsbury Publishing. I've left myself with about 25 quid left in cash. Doing all right. I don't actually have any cash coming into this portfolio now. I'm spent up until at least payday, which is in a couple of weeks' time. So back to sitting down and not doing very much.
I know it's not entirely the case with Adyen and Fortinet and something else in there, Four Corners in there as well. Close to home, seeing bargains in the UK at the moment. Steve, you know, you mentioned DS Smith a couple of times there, Bloomsbury, Entain, something else as well. I know you sold a UK thing, which was LSEG, but like the look of UK stocks right now.
I think there's a lot.
I mean,
quite
you better, because we've got three UK stocks we're talking about this week.
Yeah, I think there's quite a lot of value in the UK market at the moment, and I think I see a lot of the stocks I sort of buy are in sort of like momentary slumps in the UK, and I think that we're going to ease out of those areas soon, and hopefully they'll look like good moves. Maybe it's a bit rough to say be greedy when others are fearful on them, because I don't think that's quite the case, but there's an element of that, a small fraction of that, and that's what I'm hoping will play out.
Yeah, so I thought my portfolio followed mostly the week that everyone else's I thought was going to follow. I assume mine's had a fairly normal week, which is down at the start of the week after Israel's military action in Gaza sends oil prices and everything higher, which is sort of bad for stocks, creates uncertainty, gold prices go higher as well. Understandable stuff in terms of the market reaction, by the way. No comment on the political situation there. We're not touching that. We wouldn't touch that with someone else's, I think, in our show and our remit. After that, though, a bit more positivity. There were some members of the Fed who mentioned that long-term interest rates might, or a fall in the bond market pushing bond yields higher might substitute for interest rate rises, which is a sign or leading some people to think, in fact, the market, and statistically, I think right now, thinks that interest rates have peaked. Okay, that to me looks like a setup for a disappointment. But if we think interest rates are peaking, that's causing a bit of support for asset prices, which has been bringing things up a little bit for me. Then a bit of a kick towards the end of the week as a couple of dividends came in and I put them into some places that I'm still significantly down on. Haven't sold anything at a 15% gain. Haven't got many things that are still at 15% gains, let alone ones I'm interested in offloading particularly. But outside of the stock market, things have been sort of okay. I had my first experience of, I think, a thing every parent goes through, which is where your childcare kind of falls through. In our case, it was supposed to be nursery in the morning. Alistair was not well overnight the night before, which meant we couldn't send him in. Them's the rules. There for perfectly good reasons, which meant that we had to work out how to do childcare on Friday in the kind of emergency scramble thing, which was done by a combination of me, some grandparents, and my wife across the course of the day. So first go at the kind of scrambling everything for the emergency childcare move because we couldn't send him to nursery. How's your week been outside of stock, Steve?
Yeah, it's a sore week, Steve. So I was on site on on Wednesday, so I did a little tour of all the way up to a place called Foxholes, which I imagine not many people will know where that is, but it's about an hour away from me, and then I had to drive back past where I lived all the way down into Lincolnshire, another hour away or so. So it was nice. I went to go see some really nice buildings some kind of awkward designs that I've done over time that have sort of difficult to visualize how they look. I got to experience an MVHR system on for the first time, Steve, which, you know, with my bullishness for Zender Group was interesting to actually be in a room that's had one on. I've never actually experienced it before, and it's really a really odd experience. It's like, you know, if you're walking around your house, various rooms have different temperatures, and you can feel it when you walk around your house. It's subtly different, and the air is different in them. Well, with an MVHR system, it's all completely the same. The temperature is exactly the same, but the air just feels like you're walking in the countryside. It's really, really difficult to explain. It's really pleasant to walk around in. So he caught me gawking at one point. I was just sort of admiring my own work, my own design, and he had to ask me if I was all right, because apparently I'd been staring at like up in the sky for about 2 minutes. But yeah, it's been a decent week, Steve. I think the house, Steve, is massive. It's 20 odd meters by about 11 meters, and it goes on the corners another 14 meters by about 8 meters. It has to have a plant room because this MVHR system is so like extensive, and the house is so big. Double garage, overlooks a top golf course as well, has a balcony where you can sit out and eat your dinner, and he's planning on listing it for $600K, Steve, which down your neck of the woods, I might be lucky to get you a, you know, like a shed, you know, with maybe a single bed in it.
Yeah, house prices are down, but we're still not getting that much for, well, you're not getting something like that for $600K around here. Maybe everyone should go move to Foxholes. That's apparently where house prices, you can get some quite nice houses there then.
This one was in Waltham, which is
that was in the Lincoln bit.
Yeah, near Grimsby. Yeah. That's the problem. It's a nice part of Grimsby if such a place exists.
These things are all relative, aren't they? But yeah, you use this expression like near Grimsby and a nought falls off the end of your property price.
Yeah, but maybe unreasonably in this regard, because if you can work from home, you can essentially live anywhere, can't you?
I mean, if you live in that thing, what do you care is nearby? Only if in terms of stuff will deliver anything to you. There must be a Domino's nearby, right?
There's an everything nearby. Waltham's not a bad area, to be fair. They have a place in Waltham called Cheapside, and it always makes me laugh because that's where all the rich people live.
There's a place in London called that for the same reason, yeah. Cheapside, which is, well, I'm not sure anyone actually lives in Cheapside in London. I think it's just all offices at the moment.
Oligarchs.
Presumably empty. But yeah, okay. Consume anything any good while we're on the while we're with you? I think mine follows yours quite well here. So you kick us off with what you've been consuming.
Sure. I mean, I consumed loads of stuff this week, but I've picked a favourite, and it was the Merin Talks Money podcast with Merin Somerset Webb and John Stepek, who I think we've mentioned a few times, both of them on here. And they have an episode called Jeremy Grantham Says No One Should Invest in the US. And to be honest with you, that for me was a bit of off-putting clickbait. It was the opposite of the actual of clickbait to me. That made me look at that and go, oh, I'm not listening to this twaddle. But actually, I did listen to it, and it's very good. It's a really good episode. Mm-hmm. And so I think we've spoke about Jeremy Grantham on here before, but for people who are not entirely sure who he is, he's the co-founder of GMO. They're a hedge fund, I guess, is what you would describe them as, Steve. Is that probably the best description?
Yeah, they describe themselves as, I think, institutional money managers. Basically the same thing.
Same thing. And he is quite famous for predicting crashes successfully as well, we should say. So Jeremy Grantham predicted the tech bubble. He predicted 2008. In 2020, he was literally shouting to anybody who will listen to get the longest fixed term mortgage that you can get, because he was saying that interest rates were coming to an end. So yeah, he's been right on three occasions. The unfortunate part is he's also in between these in between these being right, he's been wrong a number of occasions as well. So there is an element of the Jeremy who cried wolf. For example, in 2011, he was saying that the next big crash was already upon us. And if you was to follow his advice, obviously you missed essentially a decade of unfettered growth. What Marx would call standing on the moving walkway, perhaps. So even if you was crap, you were getting carried, you know, crap and slow. And
just to be clear for anyone who didn't see last week's episode, this is Howard Marx, not Karl Marx, by the way.
even if you were a rubbish investor, you were getting carried by the market. So so bad call from Jeremy there. But regardless, this is interesting. He talks about, and he doesn't say no one should invest in the US. He's very focused on sort of value and quality. And that's essentially the outcome of this podcast, is that he gets to talk about why he thinks some things are overvalued, why he thinks some things are undervalued. He talks about quality. He talks about value, and then he gives some suggestions of areas he would avoid. Things like the Russell 2000, which he calls, he says it has a high level of zombie companies, and the debt levels are at record highs, and he says it's very vulnerable to rising rates, which, I mean, they're a combination that you would say that historically speaking that's correct, and that's where Jeremy Grantham gets the vast majority of his information from. He is a sort of student of investing history. So I would recommend it. There's obviously going to be a link in the description as per usual, and I'd recommend giving it a listen, even if you don't agree with Jeremy Grantham. And I don't agree with Jeremy Grantham. I don't really agree with Merriam Somerset Webb most of the time as well, but I think it's sometimes quite important to get the opposite side of the conversation, even if at the end of the day you end up just shrugging your shoulders and saying, I still think my thesis is stronger. How about you, Steve?
Jeremy Grantham is a bit of a doom merchant, isn't he? But he does have some stuff that he's really quite positive about. So I haven't seen the interview you were mentioning, but he's done a few lately. He appears to be on the kind of campaign trail. I think the reason for that is that GMO have, I think, managed to finally get permission to launch their ETF. So presumably they want some people to put some money in there. Focused on quality is the sort of nebulous-ish title of this, but they're looking for people to invest into that. So Jeremy Grantham's off on the campaign trail, from what I can see of it. He's generally thinking that things are overpriced and that won't last forever, and when it doesn't, then it will resolve itself by asset prices coming down, not by corporate earnings going up, basically. So there's two ways that overpricing corrects itself, right? One is the thing becomes worth the price, the other is the price comes down to what the thing's worth, and he's very much thinking it'll go the second kind of way. What they're famous for at GMO is, I think they didn't have a down year between 1999 and 2002. And in terms of staying out of trouble, that's pretty much as impressive as it comes. You're right in pointing out that he also, there's a little bit of the, I didn't lose any money because I never made any money, joke's on you, kind of approach to this. You would have missed out on an awful lot of stuff. But if you're looking for someone who is going to keep you well out of trouble, he's probably a decent candidate and certainly worth listening to, partly because he has really interesting ideas about green technology. He seems, as a lot of people do, climate change, global warming is the big issue of our day. He's probably not wrong there, but he is also way, way, way more bullish on our ability to solve this problem than a lot of people are. He notes that, there are still big issues to try and solve, big headwinds, big difficulties, big challenges, but the amount of progress that's been made on them is way, way, way more than anyone thought there would be. So people have been doom-mongering about renewable energy for however long, and it can't power this, and we can't store that, and so on and so forth. Grantham points out that, look, with enough attention and energy and so on, really, really impressive things have been achieved there faster than anyone can imagine. He sees that as where the real kind of next tailwind is. And with renewable energy stocks actually not doing very well just lately, they did well during the pandemic when everyone thought oil was basically finished. since then, the story has been much, much the other way around, culminating in, I guess, most recently NextEra that we talked about last week. You might think there's kind of opportunity there. So I find Jeremy Grantham an interesting guy because I think it's very easy to over-characterize him as a perma-bear about basically everything and think, well, you won't buy anything ever, basically. And that's not quite true. He has stuff that he's positive on and optimistic on, and I suppose you have to be if you're trying to sell people an ETF, because you can't just say, look, here's what we're going to do. We're going to keep the whole damn thing in cash every so often. But you were saying the importance of talking or listening to people who disagree with you, and I agree with that view. I have been doing exactly the opposite in my consumption thing for this week. I've been listening to someone, and I liked it very much because they agreed with me. And I feel good when people agree with me. So the Baron Streetwise podcast this morning is what I've been listening to. They have a guy on who runs Wedbush's REIT analysis or REIT coverage, and they've recently just kind of initiated their coverage on REITs again. It goes almost without saying that REITs have had a pretty terrible year, both in the UK and the US. Rising interest rates are not good for things like real estate investment trusts. They weigh on property prices, which is bad for things whose assets are largely properties. They make debt more expensive, which is bad for things that generally can't pay their debt out of their earnings very easily, and so on and so forth. That makes their interest payments go higher. But I've been saying, look, I think there's maybe some opportunities here in this REIT space. And last week we talked about the PRS REIT as an example of this. I don't think that's the only thing I'm particularly interested in. I think I mentioned a couple of weeks ago as well that I thought Realty Income was looking kind of attractive as well in response to a question. But anyway, I've been looking at REITs lately, and I think this is a nice time to be looking at them while they're kind of low cyclical. We all kind of want to do the Howard Marks thing of be like, well, look, here's the cycle, here's the part of the market that's out of fashion at the moment. Time to climb in here, ignore this other bit. But for quite a while, it felt like there wasn't really a part of the market that was massively out of fashion. Low interest rates and falling interest rates meant that everything just went up pretty much. So it was hard to see. Well, what's getting shaded away here? Maybe kind of consumer defensive and pharma things a bit, but they're still not like amazingly cheap. You're getting a sort of, I don't know, 2 to 3 to 4 maybe percent dividend if you push yourself out on the risk scale. Is that exciting with a long-term view? Not really. Nowadays, it seems to me like there is much more going on in a more clearly cyclical shift against real estate. Anyway, Mr. Wedbush Securities agrees with me. He's looking for a recovery next year, actually. I wasn't making claims as bold as that yet. I'm looking for a recovery eventually and to collect a decent dividend while it happens. But he also made a couple of more points that were interesting to me. One is that, okay, debt can be an issue here, but in general, when this is in the US, see how it shapes up in the UK. When we talked about yet another REIT primary health properties not so long ago, we talked about debt levels, and debt levels can be relatively high in REITs because they can't reinvest their cash. They have to go and get it from somewhere else, either by printing shares, which is a bad idea when your share price is low, or by taking on debt, which is a bad idea when rates are high. But debt is an important part of the equation here. Is that, look, if you take the REIT index and the average for the REIT index, their leverage levels are lower than the average for the S&P 500. They're generally less levered than a bunch of other things. So the debt levels aren't kind of crazy here. He also recommended a REIT that I like at the moment. It described it as an office REIT. Steve, it's your office REIT, actually, that he said. And you get tempted to lump all office REITs in together. And yes, people are dubious on the office thing because maybe lawyers and accountants and so on aren't going back to work in quite the same way. More of this stuff can be done remotely, and bankers and so on and so forth. But not all offices are the same. Not all office-based industries are the same. Alexandria Real Estate was one that he flagged as being particularly encouraging, which is also quite bullish on multifamily. And I guess that's similar to the PRS REIT that I was talking about last week, although that's not multifamily. That's housing and accommodation. So it's kind of in the same sector, but not blocks of flats in the same way.
Mid-American.
Mid-American is the kind of nearest to the housing REIT that I can think of in the US. Mm. This one was one I hadn't heard of that he was advertising, I think. But I can't quite remember that one offhand. Anyway, that's why we'll pop a link down below so people can go and find out for themselves what it is that our Wedbush Securities man likes. You like the Baron Streetwise podcast, though, Steve, right? We've mentioned it before occasionally, but I'm flagging this week's episode particularly, something I've consumed.
It's my favorite podcast. It's also so when we're driving about and I like to have podcasts on, it's my wife's least favorite podcast because she's like, all of his jokes are really shit. And I'm like, no, they're not. They're excellent.
They're really good. Yeah,
he's really good. And the the sort of combination of him and Jackson and now him and Meta. Well, it was him and Meta, him and Jackson, him and Meta. Jack and Jackson, Jack and Meta has been really good. I really enjoy it. I think the little sort of cameo bits and pieces from Meta are really funny, and he keeps it light but informative. And I think it's my favorite podcast. I think that's the one that, you know, when there's something that comes out every week that you look forward to listening to, and I never miss it. And I normally listen to it on release day, which is, I'm surprised I've missed this one. It's out a little bit early, I think. It's definitely my one of my favorites, and I look out for it. I like to be a day one on this, and I'm chuffed that they've mentioned Alexandria as well, because it's been sort of tirade of odd negative news about Alexandria. The fella who was doing GPS tracking and finding out that there wasn't as many phones in the office building as he would expect and things like that is very strange things to say when Alexandria is, yes, it's an office suite, but it's also a lab suite as much as anything. Yes, a lab, office, biotech suite, and I can't imagine, Steve, that you can do too much lab work from home.
Not even for your massive mansion in Lincoln.
Yeah, with your MVHR system, which actually probably would help you out a lot. But I don't know, Steve. I'm bullish on Alexandria. I am, and I still sort of like find it confusing to this day why other people aren't bullish on Mid-American, bullish on Four Corners Property Trust, bullish on Prologis. I've never had so many REITs in my portfolio, so maybe me and this fella at Wedbush are due a date.
Yeah, I feel like the time is coming here, which sort of... So his more nuanced view, I guess, was don't immediately go lumping into REITs right now. The time for this is probably more turn of the calendar year. Maybe. I've never had any kind of real skill for working this kind of thing out. I tend to be... One of the things I like about Howard Marks is... He puts much more emphasis on where we are rather than where we're going. I mean, exactly when are these things turning around? Don't know. Are they turning around? Yes. And where are they at the moment? Really quite low. We'll come back to that idea in a bit when we talk about Croda, because it is important. You can't just say, I have no idea about the future. But I had a quick look at Alexandria because I've also kind of quite liked the idea. It looks like it's pretty immune to sort of work from home trends, and I sort of like areas of real estate that or indeed areas of any kind of industry, but take real estate for the moment as an example, that are immune from disruption from what look like fast moving trends, which is why I kind of like Realty Income, right? They focus on convenience stores and gas stations and stuff now. That's people are not buying their convenience stuff e-commerce-ly. They can't get it there fast enough. I mean, not yet anyway. So I sort of think there's good scope there. Equally, okay, suppose for the moment you think that the work from home trend is a durable one and in general has a bit more force to it than I do. I'm kind of doubtful on that, by the way. But Alexandria isn't likely to see vast quantities of work from home action because, as you point out, building a lab in your own house is kind of impractical. And I suspect other people just have to commute to it anyway. So why they would commute there rather than somewhere else is another question as well. But I looked at that afterwards and saw that share price has gone under 100, putting its dividend yield close to around 6%. Okay, so it's a US stock, so there's withholding tax to be paid on it, which will bring that down a bit. But that's quite an interesting sort of return at those levels. The reason I hadn't been in it before is I thought, I'm not quite sure the price is quite there right now. At that level, I sort of think, well, maybe it is.
Yeah, you've got to really think, if Alexandria is not to succeed here, that you're looking at the death of biotech. Now, biotech is funded by VC at the beginning. So when VC dries up, Alexandria is likely to suffer because some but not all of its buildings are leased out to startups. You have to assume anyway, because it's very difficult to find exactly who leases everything. But the fact of the matter is, Alexandria still has a lot of big office and lab buildings actually out to big profitable biotech arms as well. So it's about figuring out how much of that is potentially, you know, how much of that Alexander is not going to get paid for with the amount that they are going to get paid for. The other good thing about Alexander is that they own clusters rather than just a building here and there. And that's how you end up with biotech clusters of companies. So they can have, you know, if they need extra space, there tends to be another office or office block within touching distance of the one they already have. So they don't have to, you know, get rid of the one they have and go and get a bigger one elsewhere. They can just tack on another building or tack on another, you know, some more square footage. So you also have that, you know, innovation tends to work better when it's all sort of clustered together. People talk to each other and share information and help each other. That also tends to be a good thing. Plus, it means that you're pretty much on the doorstep of each other, so you can hire from each other and what have you. So, Alexandria, I am and have been for a while particularly bullish on. It's just so expensive, but with a 6% dividend, Steve, you're talking about a company that doesn't have to even grow very much to justify that price. And we're not talking about a rubbish REIT here. We're talking about one with a very good credit rating, one that's had historic market beating performance, one that's debt is really, really well controlled. If you just go to their investor relations and pull up their additional financial information, you'll see the debt there. It's predominantly fixed for long terms, not a lot expiring. The stuff that does expire soon, they've got a decent enough credit rating to get at least the best offer they can get at the moment from the banks. It's not something I'm particularly worried about at all, really.
Nope.
Before we move on, a quick one from Steve and me. If you're enjoying the show, please do give us a like, a comment, and a rating on whatever platform you're listening on. And make sure you share the podcast with your investing friends. It helps us a lot, and we're really looking forward to building out something that you guys can get some value from and that we can have some fun in making. So do like, subscribe, and back on with the show.
The sucker's going up.
Okay, let's leave that one for the moment then, because I've got an eye on the time already, and we're at 25 minutes, which is good work, considering we've only talked about how our weeks have been and what we've consumed. The big issue of this week for UK investors is more noise about fractional shares in ISAs, and we, neither Steve nor I, felt we could properly ignore this. We also felt like we're not, there's limits to what we're ready in a position to contribute here, not because we think this is desperately difficult. We think there's limits to what anyone ought to be in a position to contribute here, to be honest. But Steve, you put quite a bit of time into thinking about this sort of thing. Where did you get to in the end? I put some time into this, but mostly in my head rather than by reading.
Yeah, so I wrote a piece, I deleted it, I wrote another piece, and I've deleted it since. So I'm still up in the air about where I feel about this. I think I am leaning on the side that I think HMRC is in the wrong here. Mm-hmm. I actually think they're in the wrong from both a sort of policy perspective and a moral perspective. So following sort of Damien Talks Money on this, who did a good take, 4 to 5 minutes on the facts, and then 4 to 5 minutes on his prime ministerial speech. But he's right. HMRC, what are you doing? You know what I mean? He's kind of the gist of it. So for HMRC to pursue something like this, it has to be in the public interest. Now, I don't think there's anybody here who could argue that pursuing fractional shares like this is in the public. You know, pursuing investors for fractional shares, especially the sort of people who buy fractional shares, I don't see how that can be in the public interest. So I think that's one of the things. But the other thing that was pointed out was from Dan at Tax Policy. He thinks that perhaps HMRC are misunderstanding how most modern brokerages are set up now. And I think it might be worth us just really quickly touching on that, because I don't think many of the YouTubers have touched on that. And we're looking to put something here that not everyone else has covered. But I just want to really quickly just scare over the plumbing of a modern brokerage. So before, we've said that fractional shares are essentially derivatives. Now, that is true in some cases, but it's actually not true in the way a lot of these modern brokerages work. At eToro, I would assume it will be a derivative, but at Trading 2 and 2 and Free Trade, I think it's less clear. So I've just written this quick example for you. So say we open an account with Trading212 and we buy 250 shares of Legal & General, and this is our first ever investment. So we don't own those shares technically, because those shares are bought by Trading212 on your behalf. They're pulled together with all the other shares on Trading212 in what's known as an omnibus account. So what you actually own is like a beneficial claim to a fraction of the benefit of the total pool of the Legal & General shares held by Trading212. So for ease of use, let's just say that Trading212 previously has 24,750 shares, and then they use your money, as per your instruction, to buy 250 more shares, taking us to 25,000 shares. You now have a 1% claim on the benefit of the total pool, essentially. So when the dividends come through to Trading212, you have a 1% claim on that dividend. When the voting comes through and you vote, you have, you know, your vote is worth, the way you vote is worth 1% to the way Trading212 vote overall. So, and the reason that the plumbing is this way is because of the Cas 6 rules, but also because it's about £7,500 a year plus VAT for a segregated Crest account, which I don't know many people who would think that that was a cost worth bearing. And this is no different whether you're buying fractional shares or not. So just to explain how fractional shares work, when you buy a fractional share, the brokerage just buys one full share. But because of fractional interest, there is no such thing as a fractional share. And because we're not talking about derivatives being put into accounts anymore, we're just talking about fractional interest, it doesn't really matter what that number is that you have. So if you have 12 to 24 decimal places of fractional share, that's really irrelevant, because all you have is a percentage fractional interest in the overall pool of shares. So why would fractional shares in that regard, if this is true, why would that be an issue? So long as everything is getting divided upright and voting is getting divided upright, and you know, eventually there is the ability to transfer shares around, I don't really see why this would be a massive issue for anybody, and I don't really see why it'd be a massive issue for HMRC. Now, they made a long drawn out comparison to fractional interest in buildings, which is essentially how flats or houses of multiple occupancy work. Now, Steve and I think that is both interesting and uninteresting, because it's completely different in a way and similar in a way, but I probably wouldn't have used that as my example. I think the example here is that the regulation that HMRC are looking at is from 1998. The Cas 6 regulation is much sooner than that, much more. It was in 2012, I think, or 2011. I can't remember exactly when Cas 6 came out, but it's been sooner than 1998. And one sort of supersedes the other in a way. So I just don't think HMRC have anything here that's worth pursuing. And I said to you, Steve, I think this, and the conspiracy theory here is that I just think this is all set for Jeremy Hunt to get on his little white horse and ride in the autumn statement and say, you know, fear not, young investors, the Conservative Party are here to help you, and that's not going to happen. And look at me, I'm a superhero, vote for me. And I just don't think, you know, I mean, I just don't think there's anything here. I think it's a non-story, and I said it was a non-story last time, I think it's an absolute non-story. I think it's still a non-story. And I think it is just a setup by cronies to help Jeremy Hunt look like a magician. What do you think, Steve?
I think I'm with you right up until that last point. I'm slightly dubious that this is kind of politically motivated. I might be wrong about that, but I'm also not that worried about whether it's politically motivated or not. So from what I can see of it, there are kind of a couple of questions here. One is a technical question about whether what you own when you own a fractional, quote unquote, is a share or not. The other one is whether it makes any difference to anything or ought to make any difference to anything. So call the first one the technical question, call the second one the kind of moral question. And the third one is all this muddying nonsense about buildings, which is desperately annoying to my mind. And I didn't see this as a particularly helpful way of thinking about things. The HMRC position is reasonably straightforward and, to my mind, makes absolutely no sense. When they say that shares are a qualifying thing, they think they have always been clear in their own minds anyway. Well, they have always intended this to mean whole shares, not fractional shares. I think that's nonsense. I think for until quite recently, they weren't even thinking about fractional shares. So it's not the case that they thought when this policy was drafted. Oh, by that, we definitely mean, we mean shares and whole and complete shares, not fractions of shares. What they mean is shares and not derivatives. And that's fine. That's a perfectly, well, that's a clear position. You can make of that what you think of it. You might think some derivatives are more harmful than others, but whatever. No derivatives in an ISA. Okay. Clear enough rule. And maybe it's easier to say if you think some derivatives are harmful and others are not. Let's not try and sort between them. Let's just chuck them all out for the time being. I can understand that too. I think there are a bunch of muddying questions that have nothing to do with HMRC's position. So I think there's a decent case to be made that says that everything you own in an ISA is a derivative and therefore shouldn't be allowed at all. So these omnibus account things, I was asking Paul this during the week, and you'll be amazed to hear I didn't manage to quite get a resolution on this, but suppose I'm the only person on Trading 212 who owns shares in Aviva's 9.375% preferred. That's highly possible, by the way. I might well be the only person on Trading 212 who owns that thing. So actually, basically everything in the Trading 212 omnibus account has my name next to it, as it were, or I have an entire claim on that thing. So my share in it is 1 or 100% or so on. Is it the case now that I own any shares of Aviva Preferred? I mean, arguably the answer is no. I'm still kind of adjacent to it with this omnibus thing, which they own and I have my claim on. But if I can own the whole thing and still own no shares, that sounds a lot like what I own is not a share. It sounds a lot like a derivative here. But that's got nothing to do with fractionals either, as you point out. That's just the way the omnibus accounts work. And it sounds like if HMRC want to have a problem with that, they're at liberty to have a problem with it, but that has nothing to do with fractionals per se. What it has to do with is omnibus accounts, which is just the way things work, so you don't have to set up individual accounts at your brokerage for everybody, which, as you pointed out in the written thing that you sent me, Steve, is just prohibitively expensive for most people and would squash access to basically investing for large quantities of people. On that point, then, which is the kind of moral argument here, there's a. You were saying you couldn't see any kind of case for this. I can't see a case either that convinces me. Here is the main thing that I think is. Here's what I think the best reason is, and it doesn't work for wanting to rule fractionals out of ISAs. Fractionals do make markets accessible to people, but I think there's still a sense in this country, especially at the likes of HMRC and a generation above us, that the stock market is a place where you lose all your money. And the more people have access to it, the more likely they are to do these kind of what you might loosely call casino-like activities. And we want to try and protect people from doing these casino-like activities. Raise the bar for entry, and then people will think more carefully about it. So block off fractionals. I mean, it doesn't matter in primary health properties case. The share price is under a quid. He's buying a fraction of that. I don't even think 212 won't let you buy one because the minimum transaction value is a quid. I've tried. But if you thought there was a case to be made in terms of restricting people from that, then that would be the best reason I can think of. I don't think it's a very good reason. I think in general we would do better by providing people with access to the stock market and letting them kind of work their way through understanding how these things work, maybe with different kind of guardrails to help them and so on. If someone wanted to say, look, how should we restrict access to the markets for young people in particular? Should you have minimum holding periods or whatever, whatever? I'd be there for a discussion around that. I don't think blocking fractionals is the answer to that question. I won't comment on the building comp thing. I think mostly here I'm struck with a sense of pessimism of this can only go wrong, and it can only go wrong with muddle-headed thinking from somebody. HMRC, to my mind, has demonstrated that it is perfectly capable of muddle-headed thinking in this kind of environment, which makes me wary about trying to predict how I think this is going to play out. We can all talk about how we think it should go. We can all talk about what kind of interesting arguments are. I think based on what I've read so far from HMRC, and I hope I'm wrong, and I want to think I'm wrong, but HMRC are the type of people who will get confused about share ownership and building ownership. And they will point out to me, or they will get in their heads confused with the idea of, well, think about fractional ownership in a building for a moment. Then I could fractionally own a building, and Steve could fractionally own the same building. And I could say I own a building, and Steve could say he owns a building. And then we'd say, how many buildings do you have? One. And then we get into other kind of difficult questions like, okay, Steve, point at the bit of the building that you own. I mean, it's not like he then points at the windows and I point at the roof or something when you say, I own this fraction of it, and you own this fraction of it, and so on. I think fractional ownership is a thing that needs conceptually sorting out a little bit. I'm wary about HMRC's ability to do this, and I think this is going to create confusion where none needs to be created. So I'm pessimistic here. I would take from here Jeremy Hunt sorts it all out and attempts to look like a hero in doing it. That would be quite high on my list of good outcomes, to be honest, for this.
Did you see Free Trade's community post?
No, I saw an interview with Adam Dodds in the FT, I think, who is a Free Trade guy, right?
Yeah, I'd never look at anything with Adam Dodds in it. They basically put a post onto their community that said, and it was entitled, I think in capitals, "We need your help, fractional shares in an ISA." And they do need help. And basically it was an encouragement to mass blanket mail MPs, Jeremy Hunt, whoever, they'd even written the letter for you. And the reason why I think the hysteria and the panic here, and maybe not getting the hysteria and the panic from trading 212, is that even if all of this happens, so HMRC banned fractional shares in ISAs and then whack tax bills on everything, it's not you that have to pay it. It's not me and you. It's not Steve. It's not you people listening at home. It's the people who manage the ISA. So the people who will be paying that bill are Free Trade, Trading 212, and whoever else is offering fractional shares and shouldn't be. So Trading 212, Free Trade, we need your help. The reason they're saying that is because, well, especially with Free Trade's case, we need your help. Probably because they don't really want to be paying this bill. They've needed people's help on the last 15 crowdfunding raises they've done. They're still nowhere near.
Let me see if I can tempt you with a question here. Do you think Free Trade will find a way of passing that through, either by attaching more fees to ISAs or pensions or whatever?
I don't, because they have committed to paying this bill regardless, if it needs to be done. But they've written that in such a way that they seem to have neglected the position that they have to pay it. It's their job to pay it. Do you know what I mean? It's like, we will do this for you. It's like, yes, because you have to.
Yeah.
It's your responsibility.
We will pay what? Our fine for you.
But if it's a big fine, Steve, I wonder where, well, if it's a big fine, people will be paying the fine for Free Trade because they'll be back at the well again, won't they?
So. Kind of what I mean. It's got to come from somewhere, right? Yeah, I wonder whether it might come from some hikes in ISA fees or whatever.
Will Free Trade be the first ever company to hit treble digit crowdfunding rounds?
Oh, wow. I have no idea. At what point do you just give up when you hit further crowdfunding rounds?
Well, I'm sure they're just trying. They're like, they must be like, somebody, please buy us and put us out of our misery.
Come on, we've been running this thing long enough. We're due a payday, right?
Well, I don't want Dodsey to get a payday.
Oh, okay then. Let's talk about business we probably feel a bit better about for the moment then, in that case. Let's talk about some stocks, and you can try and buy a fraction of them in your ISAs if you like. I was going to talk about this last week, I promised I would, and then didn't because we ran out of time, and it's going to happen again if we're not careful. So B&M European Value, this is my other stock for Paul, who is, alas, not here. I missed my opportunity with him a week ago, so in 10 months' time, I'll have thought of a different one, so don't worry. Anyway, at the time I wrote this, this stock was up 75% over the last 12 months, and it feels really hard to be thinking about a stock that's up 75% in the last 12 months and thinking, I think this might be reasonable value still, but it has a PE ratio of 16 on a trailing space, and it looks like there's growth coming. 16, by the way, again, at the time I wrote this, and probably still is, to be honest, not too far away, it's only a week ago, was pretty much the PE ratio of the S&P 500. So it's in line with the average of those things. B&M European Value, as I'm sure most people know, but Steve, you probably know it firsthand here, they run a combination of discount retail outlets. They have B&M Value UK or Britain, and they have an arm in France that is much smaller than the British arm. And they also flog frozen food out of this thing called Heron. Before I carry on, Steve, familiar with Heron?
Headquartered in Hull.
Headquartered in Hull, like everything, apparently. Just up the road from you or across from where you work or something like that.
I'm fairly certain it is. Anyway, I'm just going to check that, Steve, while you talk. But I'm fairly certain the branch in Melton is their headquarters. Or I think it might even be a whole company.
So for those that don't know, by the way, I did my studying not so far up the road from Steve. I studied in Sheffield for sort of most of my degree stuff. And I do remember going past a lot of Heron Foods things. I remember thinking at the time they're probably a bit of a commodity because you can buy you could buy frozen food basically anywhere in Sheffield. I tended to go to a place called Fulton's, which I'm not sure whether that's a thing that's made its way across the whole. But, Steve, is Heron a local business for you?
Yeah, so here's an interesting one. If you want to contact head office, you can go to Speak, which is Liverpool, or you can send a letter to Melton, which is just down the road from Hull. It's got a Hull postcode. So interesting. I do think they are headquartered in Hull. I wonder if the Speak address is maybe B&M's registered office now, because B&M bought Heron, didn't it? But yeah, fairly certain Heron is or was a Hull headquartered company. We have a lot of Herons in Hull. We have a lot of Icelands in Hull. We have a lot of frozen food in Hull and farm foods. There's another one. To be honest with you, I'd forgotten that they'd bought them, though. So that's quite an interesting little outfit. So yeah, carry on, Steve.
So aside from their obvious geographic advantage, meaning that they have very low overheads at their head office, because apparently they also don't pay for the internet. They just get the post delivered and have people walk up their office in Liverpool. They also have some other kind of advantages here. So they're a discount retailer, albeit in a specific kind of way. And we know that discount retail has been doing quite well lately. And we know this from the case of the likes of Lidl and Aldi, but we'll come back to how they compare in a little bit. The thing with discount retailing, though, is you tend to associate retailing full stop with lousy margins, which is why other places aren't discount retailers. But when you look at operating margins for B&M, those are hovering around the 10% over the last 5 years, Mark. That's not terrifically high, but if you compare it to somewhere like a Tesco or a Sainsbury's, their margins are around 2%. Margins are around 2% there for the last 5 years. And what does that mean? That means if you're worried about this thing called inflation, which arguably you still should be if you run a 2% operating margin business, you will face higher input costs as a retailer. They do show up here quite a bit. Branded stuff, especially with the likes of what B&M deals in, rather than the kind of, well, officially rather than the own brand Lidl, Aldi, Paradise. But increasingly I'm finding things in Aldi and Lidl that are branded and catching my eye a bit. But anyway, higher input costs. B&M are currently around 15% below their rivals in terms of average pricing. It gives them room to come up. They have a 10% op margin, which gives them room before they start going unprofitable. And they can shift then flex their pricing, which I think is quite powerful to hang on to their customers in ways that the likes of Tesco, well, it's hard to see how they do that. Chief reported in one of their recent trading updates, this is why I was writing about them last week, that actually they do pretty well in stores that are located near Aldi's and Lidl's. You would expect them to be kind of coming under pressure there, but sales are pretty strong in those sorts of areas. Anyway, you'd expect them to do well in the cost of living crisis as well, and they are doing well in the cost of living crisis, but the lazy thing is to say, aha, cost of living crisis, inflation, potential higher rates, potential recession, so on. Of course, they're doing well. This is a cyclical shift, but they've been doing well before that. They have two main kind of avenues for growth, right? One is selling more stuff out their existing stores, and the other is buying more stores. They are looking to expand in both ways, and even before there is any kind of sense of cost of living stuff, they've been doing more money, boosting revenue, stuff going higher in ways that are really quite impressive. Their latest kind of big push, and the reason they've kind of come across my radar here, is Wilko going bust. It means that there's a bunch of retail units up for grabs fairly cheap, and B&M is looking to kind of seize some here. They've got plans to buy, I think, 51 of them for what's described as up to £13 million, and I'm not quite sure what the up to means there, but that might be a sign it comes in slightly lower than that, or there's some bits that are still conditional, perhaps. This is kind of the classic theme that I've been going on about lately of, okay, you have a sector that's under pressure, high street retail and so on. What you see is your weakest players, your Wilcos and so on, going bust. And actually what that creates is opportunities for other people, your B&Ms and so on. Yeah, they're under pressure at the moment. Inflation isn't good for them either. But as your competitors go bust, you have a chance to pick up stuff cheap here. And if you're in a position to hang on and do well, and tough it through the kind of difficult bits, you can do well on the other side here. They're aiming to, well, they've got aims for their store count, but I think the Wilco stuff basically makes that redundant. They're going to blast through their target for numbers of stores, from what I can see of it, and their revenue is up around 13% as a result. It's growing quite nicely, Steve. It's not a glamorous brand by anyone's estimations, I think. B&M European Value. It feels like a kind of grubby business in a certain way, and stuff that falls off the back of lorries, but I quite like the look of it. Do you think Paul should? Dividend yield is a couple and a bit percent, I think.
Yeah, I like this, Steve. I, to be honest with you, I would never have guessed that it's doing as well as it is. I'm just looking now at just even the segment revenues. So B&M UK is growing at 11.3%. That's now just over £1 billion. Heron Foods is growing at just under 20%, which is 135 million. And B&M France is growing at 29.1%. And that's at about 120 million. So if Heron and B&M France can continue growing at that kind of rate, and B&M UK can just trundle along, you've got a business here which will double its revenues inside like 4 to 5 years, which is, you know, is quite interesting kind of growth. It's strange, isn't it? You never think about, you're thinking about B&M doubling its revenue in 5 years is a very strange thing to say out loud in my head. I've been in a few B&M, Steve. I quite like to get the scampi fries and the bacon fries from there, but I would never expect it to be, not as big as it is. It's quite a big, quite a sizable outfit, but also growing at the pace that it is.
When you go to these things, everything about them to me screams high street casualty.
Yeah.
They appear to have a kind of weird mishmash of stuff. Their branding looks cheap, and not like in a, you know, Aldi kind of is cheap and you associate it with being cheap. But from the outside, the thing doesn't look like it's cheap particularly. They have a horrible set of colours at B&M. They
massive
feel like
stores.
An easy jet. Yeah. They feel like an easy jet of retail. And yet, it seems kind of hard to argue that they're doing anything other than really, really well here. And they're at a price-earnings ratio of 16, which is, that's up 75%. I mean, it gets tempting to start thinking about, oh, how things were kind of 12 months ago and so on. But if they're the time to not get anchored here and just take the thing at face value, I mean, maybe this is it, right? It's hard to be in that situation.
Up 35.61 year to date, Steve's having an absolutely corking year. If you take it as a full year, up 83.14%. So, kind of incredible. It was. It looks like it's been flat probably up until 2020-ish, and then it's just raced off, fell back down to earth again, and then raced off again, Steve. So, a very interesting looking business. It is approaching all-time highs, though, and the last time it got here, Steve, it halved, and it'd be interesting to see what exactly happened there that made it half, or what people were thinking was so wrong with the business. But
when was it last here?
It was last here in just the end of 2021, so 640 in 2021, and it fell all the way down to 307. So in 2022 it bottomed, which was obviously 2022 was a bad year, but B&M seems to have suffered particularly harshly. So interesting to see what exactly that is, but it's hard to deny it's performed well since then, Steve.
Want to have a look at it a bit more, perhaps? Let us know in the comments. Oh, I saw someone, by the way, last thing from the I saw someone posted in the Discord Shares magazine, the AJ Bell publication, were having a look at this and comparing it to Dunelm. I think I was sort of reasonably positive on both and thinking that Dunelm was a slightly better option here. Dunelm is strikes me as much more cyclical. I get that they have a fairly low-cost kind of model-ish, or they tend to be down the cheaper end of home furnishings and the like, and we have quite a bit of Dunelm stuff in our house, as you might imagine for the likes of us. But I kind of like B&M more in terms of it being relatively acyclical here. I never say stuff is entirely acyclical, but I feel like there's more cyclical protection from B&M.
You would assume that B&M would perform better in the cost of living crisis than Dunelm. Dunelm is more tied to the home improvement market, which is obviously quite slow at the moment. And I was looking at Travis Perkins as well, just as another one. They've got the opposite issue to everyone else. Their profit warning isn't necessarily because the building industry is slow. The building industry is slow, but that's not their problem. Is that they're buying a lot of building materials, and building materials have gone through a massive patch of deflation. So anybody with low inventory levels can charge things out at a relatively cheap price because there's been big deflation in prices. And Travis Perkins has this problem where they've got some very high priced inventory that they paid a lot of money for, but if they don't discount it to match, you know, what can you do about it? I mean, you won't sell it, so they've got to get through it. And yeah, that's been why Travis Perkins have issued their profit warning recently.
Should we talk about building and profit warnings then, Steve?
Let's do it. So I got asked this week if we would cover Forterra, and I said we wouldn't have time, but we've got 6 minutes, Steve, so we will try and rattle through it as quick as possible. But so just quickly, so Forterra's new CEO, Neil Ash, and my shared optimism for the building industry this year has taken a bit of a battering in the last couple of months. We were both expecting a sort of spluttering start, but then for demand to strengthen again in the back end of the year, once interest rates started to just, you know, to sort of like peak out, or we sort of saw light at the end of the tunnel. That's not happened. And I'm experiencing this in my job as well as he is in his. Demand has totally fallen away. At work at the moment, we're running about 55% of capacity. And Forterra aren't faring really much better than that. So in the last 6 months, Forterra is down about 28%. And let's not lie to each other, it probably deserves to be. 11.5% of that drop happened this week as they dropped out a couple of pieces of bad news. Piece one was that they're mothballing a second factory, an aircrete factory in Lancashire. This is following their closure of Howley Park earlier this year, which is a brick factory. As previously explained, when I went through how to build a wall, which we did do for people who are new, essentially, this is a brick factory and a block factory, the two things you need to build a wall. It makes total sense that if you close one, the other one is likely to follow. And these two closures should save Forterra around $23 million in operating costs. So the second piece of news, as I've been alluding to, is that they have followed builders merchant Travis Perkins this week and issued a profit warning. Forterra is expecting about an 18% decline in revenue and about a 52% decline in pre-tax profit. Now, this sounds awful, but brick dispatches are down about a third in the UK, and Forterra is heavily exposed to the new build market. So a fun fact for you here, Steve, that brick dispatches are actually now below 2009 levels. So they're down quite a bit. So like Competition Ibstock, Forterra has been investing, has some excellent new facilities coming online in Desford, which are unfortunately selling into a declining market. But the logic behind these investments is still pretty solid in my head. Britain needs infrastructure. Britain needs bricks. We don't build enough. We don't have enough domestic supply for what we need in the future. I think this is one of those cases of short-term pain, long-term gain. So I was reading the Investec analyst report on this, and they reckon Forterra will do about 13p in EPS this year, which is about half of last year. And I'd expect the dividend to go with this, because they like to keep the payout ratio around 50-55%. I expect the market won't like that, Steve. It's a common saying that problems come in threes, so this is likely what's going to happen. But still, that leaves you about 10 times earnings at the moment, so that's reasonable. I don't think that's an expensive price at all. So to finish with our Forterra update, I think we've still got saviours on the horizon here, and we're heading towards an election year, and political parties have used the housing market to dangle carrots in front of voters, and initiatives to help or solve, or you know, help solve or help fix the country's housing crisis are almost definitely going to be on the way, even if it's just to win votes. Any action on that front quickly improves the landscape for Forterra, and I'm all ready for it, Steve. This is one of your bigger positions, Steve. It's about 1.5. No, it's not. It's about a 3% position for me. So it's a fairly sized position. It's down about 30% on mine. Might be a bit more than that. Might be 35%. Still positive on this?
It's a reasonable sized position for me, certainly. Yeah, it's about twice what it is in yours, I think. I'm around the 7 just over percent. Things shift around, so that changes. Still positive on this. Wary of a couple of headwinds, I guess. Not really short-term ones. So here's a bit where we said we'd come back to what happens when your earnings get pushed out into the future. Long-term thesis still intact. Timeline is what's going wrong here. We were thinking that, and Neil Ash was thinking that, building work would be starting to recover here. It's not. The ONS report earlier this week on UK GDP was positive on UK GDP for August. It said it was up and growing very slightly compared to an expected decline. What it was not positive on was construction, and what it was really not positive on was UK residential construction, which was leading construction lower, basically. There were declines across the construction sector, housing being a kind of big one of them. So that ain't happening at the moment, and arguably it's not happening anytime soon, and the longer that takes, the longer it is that your apparent profits come through. That's okay if you have a long-term time horizon. The cost of, with interest rates where they are at the moment, the cost of money isn't zero, and it's worth being attentive to that. So a pound today is worth a lot less than sorry a lot more than a pound in 2 years' time at the moment. But nonetheless, at a low enough price, it's still worth having, and I think 10 times earnings is still good here. The bigger issue for Terra, from what I can see of it, is that this can't run itself out indefinitely. You pointed out the kind of headwind, I guess, coming of passive house causing demand for bricks to fall. Brick demand is still pretty good in the UK, but the more we shift away from brick-intensive construction models, the more we get into potential kind of issues for Forterra. So the concern is if the demand gets pushed too far up the chain, it just evaporates, and then that is an issue, or it goes down effectively. Inventory at the wrong time is an issue. To be honest, for stuff like Travis Perkins, and we're seeing that in quite a few industries at the moment, including one that I'll talk about next week, which is what's bothering Croda International, but that's also kind of catching my eye. I'm still positive on Forterra for the moment. I'm certainly not thinking of selling it here. Half the dividend, okay, so I kind of bought it earlier this year, I think, with a view to things will get worse before they get better. And that's certainly happening. I think there's scope to kind of keep going through this. It's higher on my buy list now, believe it or not, even though I'm kind of seeing bad news coming in. Bad news coming in to me does look like short-term bad news rather than long-term bad news, with that caveat of, okay, but if the kind of promise of profits get pushed further and further into the future, time value of money a little bit, but I get more concerned that they just won't appear.
Yeah, fair enough. I'm not that far down the line. I think this is all going to come out in the wash. I think we've still got plenty of stuff, good stuff ahead for Forterra here. One of the things I did spot, Steve, when I was reading through the regulatory news yesterday, and I was just double checking what the company was called because I'd forgotten to write it down. But Vulcan Value Partners, a decent sized hedge fund in America. They own about 12% of Forterra previous to last month. They actually bought about another 1 and a bit percent. So they now own about 13.5% of the voting rights on Forterra. So they have upped their stake in the last month. Not obviously didn't get wind of the profit warning that was coming. But potential here for a big American company to pick up a small British brickmaker for very, very cheap and hairs in the pocket here, Steve?
Yeah, that wouldn't be good for me with the amount I'm down on this at the moment. My intention is to keep buying this thing, but a couple of things. One is at 7% of my portfolio, I would need to put quite a bit into this to get that average somewhere where I wouldn't mind being bought out at, or I wouldn't mind being bought out at a 20% premium. If I get taken out at a 20% premium from here, I'm making a loss. Probably. It'll come down to how much I got back in dividends, and I can't remember. So it'll be tight, but I didn't buy this thing for it to be tight. I could buy more shares, and I could do that, but it has to be outside the ISA, and I haven't got any dividends due for the next little while now. We go into earnings season, which, by the way, started yesterday. We haven't talked about that. We'll probably talk about that next week, I guess. Good news for banks. Good news for backward-looking data about the US. Forward-looking data is where it's at, though, and we'll see more of that coming up in the next 7 days or so. Dividends aren't really coming here. I wouldn't mind buying more Forterra things, but to your thought, let's finish where we started then for the moment. You cleared out of the London Stock Exchange group, which, by the way, I'm now seeing quoted as the source of earnings estimates rather than Refinitiv, because they've kind of fully amalgamated themselves and relabeled themselves. I'm looking there, and I'm not really seeing anything that I'm kind of prepared to part with at the moment, even whether it's up or whether it's down. There's not much I really want to sell right now.
Yeah, same as me, really. Now it's all about new money for me from here on, and I think you're in a position where you can't actually put any new money in, so you're in a slightly worse. You're in a position I was in last year when stuff was getting cheap, and I was like, I can't put any more money in this damn thing. And I ended up
It goes in the invest now for me.
I ended up putting nearly $6,000 in the Capital Incinerator, which which was probably not my most sensible idea. But yes, if just quickly looking at Forterra now, it's under 300 million market cap. So, and they've just spent, the best part of a quarter of that making Britain's best brick factory. So you're talking about picking up a company for 300 million who's just built Britain's best brick factory. Give it a 20% premium, 360 million? That's a scary thought.
Thing looks cheap, doesn't it? And the other thing you kind of need to keep your eye on, I guess, in these times for cyclical businesses where they're going through the down bit and profits are going to be lower for the time being is balance sheet. I'm not worried about that with Forterra. The real reason you get into trouble in a down cycle is because you have debts that come due and you can't pay them, or you have to do something about them. You end up kind of ruining yourself because you don't have the balance sheet strength. That can happen when you've been flinging out big investments in a kind of uptime here. But I don't think it's true of Forterra. I think they have the balance sheet to kind of make this through, albeit by cutting costs on production where production isn't justified at the moment.
Fairly shocked that the big house builders are taking a look at Forterra here and saying, you know, we could have a chunk of this, or we could have this, you know, for 300 million. It's just like cancelling one dividend for them, isn't it? Cancel one dividend, buy Forterra. And then I suppose, would it be allowed to go through?
Worth a try. Why you couldn't try and integrate your kind of brick supply here. Say, right, okay, now we have an edge on bricks because we've got Desford and so on.
Yeah, I'd have a stab at it.
How big is Ibstock, by the way? Cancel about three dividends and buy them both.
Yeah, about 500 million. That's the shocking thing, I think, is that maybe there's a merger ahead that tends to happen when things like this happen. Companies like to merge together and make a stronger conglomerate against the competition. There's also, is it Michelmarsh?
Yeah, I don't know how to pronounce it. I know how it's written, yeah.
But when I'm out and about, Steve, on sites, I'm seeing a lot of Wernerberger, which is an Austrian brand, which you just don't see. Why the hell is Austrian bricks coming into the UK? That just should be banned.
Oh, gosh, you sound like an old person. All these foreign bricks taking up
coming
the spaces
over here,
of our...
taking our bricks.
There's no houses left for our bricks to build.
That should have been the condition of Brexit.
That should have been a condition of Brexit. I'm amazed it wasn't. Oh, there we go. That feels like the place to finish. Thank you very much for watching this week's Playing Footsie show. I've been Steve. I've been here with Steve. Maybe Paul will be back next week. Who knows? Who really cares? But till then, bye for now.